This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. Now, this is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and right here on the air, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. Now, one of our favorite doctors will be joining us in a little while to discuss the economy, specifically jobs, housing, and the stock market. Her name is Senior Economic Analyst Dr. Neela Richardson. She'll tell us the good, the bad, and the ugly of all those numbers in just a little while. We'll kick off the program with a topic that may be a bit confusing to some, so we've dispatched Director of Legislative Analysis Lauren Duggan and Senior Budget Analyst Cameron Luthy to help us understand the budget. Fiscal 2013 budget has yet to be delivered by the President. Why is that? We've got a continuing resolution in place to help fund the government until that time. Both the House and Senate have their ideas, but no real answers at this point. What in the world does this all mean? Who controls the checkbook of the United States of America? Lauren Duggan, Cameron Luthy, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So my first question to you guys, the gurus with regard to the budget or lack thereof for 2013, where is it? What's taking so long? Lauren, you want to chime in here?
Well, the House has passed a bill that would keep the government funded through September 30th. Continuing and there's a hard deadline of March 27th. There's a softer deadline of kind of this Friday, because that's when the Easter recess is supposed to start and members will leave town for 2 weeks. Every sign points to them getting it done before they leave. It's just a question of how quickly they get it done. The Senate wanted to amend the House bill and is poised to do so by adding additional bills. So what will happen is many agencies will be funded at their levels last year. Some will have some variation and fluctuations in there. And the idea behind that was to cushion the blow of sequestration, a topic we've brought up many times on the show, because sequestration takes across-the-board cuts. And if you have a little bit more money, it makes that cut a little easier to deal with. So that was one of the ideas they pursued when they came up with the spending bill.
Cameron, with regard to the continuing the spending at last year's levels, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem in two ways. First of all, money's in the wrong places.
Exactly.
So there's money where they don't want it and not enough where they do need it, because you're locked into last year's spending levels. The other problem is for those agencies, and it depends on what we end up with, but those agencies that are operating under a formula continuing resolution for the rest of the year, no new starts. So if they had planned to launch a new program, start up a new office, do something different from a contractual standpoint, sorry, Charlie, you're out of luck.
No cash. Sorry, yeah. Can't do it.
Can't do it.
So this brings us to this year's budget, where we're discussing, we've got Paul Ryan and the Ryan plan, so to speak, and I'm doing the air quotes, and Patty Murray, her budget. I've watched both of them, talk about both of them. They couldn't be more diametrically opposed. I think Paul Ryan even mentioned that the House plan is in another solar system as opposed to theirs. I understand there's a difference. This is the reason for this study, the analysis that you guys put together. By the way, it's called House and Senate Budgets Compared, which we definitely need, because you need a scorecard to keep track of who's doing what. Lauren, walk us through the Ryan plan and some of the bits and pieces as opposed to the Murray plan.
Well, I think it's important to talk about what this document is. And it's, some people call it a blueprint or a non-binding resolution. It's not something that's going to cause money to go out tomorrow, this budget plan. But what it is it's the budget committee stepping back, taking a look at everything the government does, the money it takes in through taxes and the money it spends through mandatory and discretionary programs. So it's a tough challenge. You've got to write down everything you want to do and kind of make the numbers work. Paul Ryan's plan, the way he's making the numbers work, is to make a number of spending cuts. I think it's $4.6 trillion in deficit reduction over the next decade, with the goal of having a small surplus in fiscal 2023. So that's a long way out and a lot can happen. But if his plan were followed, that's where he says he'd take the country. One of the ways he says he's going to do that is by repealing the president's health care law that was signed in 2010. Now, you know, if you're a Democrat who's fought hard for that law and you look at last year's election results, you may think that's never going to happen. And, you know, there's been a lot of questions about whether that or not you can get to that number with the health care law in place, or if there's no chance of repealing it. Other things he wants to do is cut other programs, spending programs on the mandatory side, and his Medicare plan, which this is something that's come up a couple of times now, about changing the structure of Medicare for people who are retiring, not today, but maybe 10, 11 years from now, to get a voucher or premium support to help them buy health insurance rather than the current fee-for-service Medicare system.
Paul Ryan says that their difference basically is anywhere from $0 to $4 trillion. They can, how are they going to mediate? How are they going to come to the, well, they got to figure out a number that's anywhere between $0 and $4 trillion. I don't see that happening very easily. That's me. He also mentioned that with regard to healthcare, we're at least 2 years away from ever being able to implement any portion of this healthcare. So Lauren, Cameron, I turn to you with regard to the discord between the two of them. There is no way to mediate.
No. And I think it's important to understand a couple of things process-wise. The House is going to pass its budget resolution.
Right.
The Senate is going to pass its budget resolution. They're very different. There is not going to be any effort to reconcile the differences. It's just not going to happen. But that doesn't mean these aren't of use. These budget resolutions will guide all subsequent legislation that has a spending aspect or a revenue aspect by the authorizing committees for the rest of the year in these separate bodies, in the House and Senate. So there's utility in having these budget resolutions, these roadmaps, these blueprints, whatever you want to call them, passed, which, you know, as everybody points out, the Senate hasn't done in 4 years. So even though there's not going to be a meeting of the minds between the House and Senate, there's still value in having these blueprints passed.
Right. And a point Cameron made, the Senate hasn't passed or adopted a budget resolution in 4 years, but look at all the spending and tax legislation that's happened. You don't need this document in place. You don't need to come to an agreement. It makes it a lot easier because we're all on the same page.
Sure.
But the world goes on. The government's still funded through separate legislation. It's not as dire as some people have made it out. Now, it is important for a governing party to lay out its vision for where it wants to take the country. And that rhetorical and political part of that document is almost sometimes more important than its actual procedural role.
Let's say we come to the end of the life of this continuing resolution,
right,
and we still don't have a decision. Is that possible?
Clearly it is, but the appropriators will have at least some guidelines with what to work with. They have a top line number that says your 12 bills combined can only spend this much money, and that's guiding for them, but they work on the details. So the spending bills, which we have to do another round of these before September 30th or another CR, those will happen regardless of what happens with this budget resolution debate.
But you could very well have the spending bills in the House would add up to a smaller number than the spending bills in the Senate. So, you know, ultimately there will need to be some meeting of the minds,
sure,
but it needn't happen now.
I'm looking into the future. The continuing resolution expires. They draft another one, and we have that safety net to allow the government to continue to work. No new startups again under this new continuing resolution. So
at least for some agencies.
At least for some agencies. You're still spending at the previous year's levels. Just dig in a deeper hole.
Well, it depends on what the mission of the agency is, and it depends on what programs they're. Some agencies are more in a steady state, sort of status quo. Other agencies that were looking to do something new and different, that's where the problem will fall. Now, it's important to point out that in the Senate version of the H.R. 933, the bill that would provide funding through September 30th, there's full-year line item numbers for DOD, VA, Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, NASA, NSF, did I miss any? VA.
Yeah.
So, oh, and the Department of Homeland Security. So it's, you know, a significant portion of the government will have the ability to do new starts, will have specific funding levels that are either up or down from the 12 levels. It's the other agencies, HHS, labor, education, transportation, that are going to be sort of stuck in a rut, as you might put it.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're speaking with Lauren Duggan, who's the Director of Legislative Analysis, and Cameron Luthy, Senior Budget Analyst, who have penned a legislative analysis entitled House and Senate Budgets Compared. And it's something that we definitely need, a roadmap to figure out who has done what. We've already been discussing healthcare and the difference in spending that we found. Another area where there's a huge difference is taxes with regard to revenue. The House plans assumes no new money, where the Senate assumes $975 billion. Again, where do you meet the minds here, Lauren?
That's difficult because I don't think zero is a starting position exactly. as much as it is kind of a philosophy almost. That
right.
A religion.
Right. On January 2nd, or January 1st, I should say, when they were debating the big deal that kept us from going over the fiscal cliff, Dave Camp, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, got on the floor and said, we've agreed now that this is much how much revenue we should bring in as a country. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, that's going to be the new line. And they've maintained that ever since. The idea is that with the tax increases that were put into place on the higher income individuals, that that's the amount of revenue that we're going to live with, and we can't have any more. So if you're going to achieve deficit reduction, that all has to come on the spending side. And that's been a pretty consistent Republican talking point since then. Democrats want to raise more revenue. They don't necessarily want to do it through the tax rates, but they want to look at tax breaks and tax expenditures and other ways that there's, some would say, spending through the tax code by giving incentives for people to do certain behaviors to reduce their tax burden. So I think that there is going to be a discussion on this, and it may come in the context of tax overhaul or tax reform, many people call it, because people want to look at the corporate tax system. The rates, some say, are too high. Higher than any other country, I think, many people point out. So they do need to address that. They want to address that. But the question is, if tax overhaul has to be revenue neutral, the way that Republicans want, no new money coming out of it, and Democrats want to raise money, that complicates even something people agree on, making the tax system simpler, fairer, easier to navigate.
I think the key there is you have to differentiate between corporate tax reform on the one hand and changes to individual tax rates. That's probably less likely to have any changes there. And the line in the sand that was drawn after the January deal is probably pretty hard to cross. But corporate tax reform, there's a decent chance of something happening there because both sides want something done. The tricky part is, when you're talking bargaining chips, what do you give away? And for what? What do you get? So if you do corporate tax reform, does that get you a deal on spending for FY14 that's higher than the caps, the low set of caps? Or is it something that you wouldn't want to bargain for just a one-year deal on spending? Would you want to bargain for a multi-year deal on spending?
I'll give you my key to the executive washroom for a week if I can park in your space. It's basic negotiation is what's going on, and it's not happening.
Right, and that's understandable for now. But as we move into the summer, that's when you'll see signs of people looking at, okay, we got to do a deal on spending for 14, otherwise we're going to the lower set of caps, and neither side seems to want that.
And there's also, you know, all year long we've looked at deadlines and days. I think the next big deadline, because the March 27th end of government funding doesn't seem to be that big of a deal.
No,
there's a deal on the table. There's something ready to happen. But the debt limit, it'll be restored in May, and the government or the Treasury Department will use its tools to keep that extended into August. So this summer, we're looking at probably another big debt limit discussion, and that always fosters the talks again about the grand bargain, a small bargain, some sort of way to address the deficit challenges so that we don't have to borrow as much money into the future and don't need to raise the debt limit higher and higher and higher and higher. It will have to go up, but there's going to be another discussion, as there was in August 2011, which gave us things like sequestration, right, automatic spending caps, and things like that.
This just brings me back to what I said at the beginning of the program. Who does control the United States checkbook? And right now, it appears as though no one.
Well, divide and control, this is what can happen.
It's what the founding fathers, in some sense, envisioned. Yeah. Perhaps not with the sort of flavor of the 24-hour news cycle and social media, perhaps, but balance of power is part of the game.
Cameron Luthy, Lauren Duggan, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And it's that time of the month again. We bring in our favorite doctor, Dr. Neela Richardson, who's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government, to help us break down the things we're seeing in the economy as we talk about jobs and housing and, you know, and such.
And such. So I'm prepared to talk about all three. Thanks for having me, Al.
Anytime. Thank you for being here. So tell us, the jobs numbers came out, good, bad, indifferent. Where are we with this?
They were terrific. They were fantastic. In fact, if you could make up a jobs report, there are some aspects in which you would put into this report. I mean, we saw that the economy added 236,000 jobs in the month of February. That's
nice.
Huge. And it's much bigger than the average had been over the last several months. There was a little wind knocked out of that headline numbers sale, though, because January's numbers were revised down to about 120,000 jobs from 157. So we're seeing an economy that's bumping along pretty well, pretty steadily. It got a huge burst in terms of the jobs numbers in February. And the unemployment rate edged down to about 7.7%.
Nice, not bad. And hopefully not too many, much of that is people just falling off the system.
Yeah, some of that is people just falling off the system. And in fact, that unemployment rate is going to look a little bumpy, and it should, as the economy recovers. Because as it recovers, more people are going to understand that there are jobs out there and re-enter the labor market, which may cause that rate to rise back up again. That's not bad news. What we should be focused on every single month is the jobs created.
One area where jobs are being created a lot, at least that I can see in my area, is with regard to housing. A lot of new houses are going up. And when I say houses, it depends on where you are. We're not looking at single family homes. In a lot of cases, it's condos, apartments. So you've got construction jobs now being beefed up. And in the area of Fort Meade, with the base realignment and closure, lots of industries are moving into that area. I know NSA is going to be expanding with a whole bunch more jobs. I was reading in the paper just a couple of weeks, I guess it was last week. I don't have a specific number, but lots of divisions are coming over to NSA, creating jobs in the Odenton-Fort Meade area where jobs are desperately needed and a revitalization desperately needs to occur. Let's talk about housing. Where are we at this point? You hear stories that the inventory seems to be shrinking. Fewer people are foreclosing?
Well, there's definitely fewer foreclosed homes on the market. It's absolutely true that in many areas of the country, inventory is shrinking. It's also true that the predominant buyers in these areas are investors. So we haven't quite seen the resurgence of the traditional home buyer, definitely not the first-time home buyer. But what we are seeing is the investors moving into prime locations, mainly along the East and West Coast, mm-hmm. and propping up those prices a bit. And also moving into places that people, buying in places that people like to vacation, like Phoenix, like Florida.
I'm going to Phoenix. So is that a smart move at this point? The economy is not has not necessarily rebounded entirely. I guess it's a smart move on their part to invest in the hopes that eventually it will turn around. But with jobs still not there completely,
right.
Are people going to be able to afford to rent or purchase from these investors?
That's a great question. And I think a lot of buyers are facing really a hard time getting a mortgage these days. The underwriting requirements have tightened extremely, so you have to have a high FICO score. You have to have a down payment if you want to get a conventional mortgage, and so that is a factor. Another factor is, which may be permanent, may be temporary, is that the attitude towards home buying has changed. And in that sense, investors may be really in on a market where people would rather rent than buy. And that's okay.
I have friends who are saying to themselves, you know what, I own this house. I don't want to own it anymore. I don't want to be tied down. Right. I'm going to sell it and just rent.
Right.
Until such a time that I feel comfortable purchasing, probably at retirement.
You know, young people these days, the millennials, those people that are not us, are delaying all kinds of decisions these days. They're delaying marriage, they're delaying having children, and they're delaying the decision to buy a home. And so they are the prime candidate to move into these condos and rent and do that kind of thing. So you're going to see more of that in the near future.
See, you call them millennials, and the way you describe them, I'm calling them slackers.
No, our generation was the slackers.
These
20-somethings, they're taking over the world.
That's a good point. Good point.
But also you bring a good point out about the jobs market. We saw a great read of the economy in terms of jobs in February, but we can't forget that there are still 12 million Americans who don't have a job. 40% of them is what we classify as the long-term unemployed, meaning they haven't had a job in, you know, several months. And so that's impactful. It's going to impact the economy. And the pockets of resurgence like Fort Meade are really important. Let's hope the politicians don't mess that up with the sequester.
I know. The sequester could cause some issues, but from what I can gather, at least in that area with the divisions they're talking about moving over, it doesn't appear as though it's going to impact them. These are divisions that already exist. And maybe moving, and hopefully won't be scaled down, because the redevelopment over there is just phenomenal. I'm going to be talking to somebody from the paper that I read this in, the Arundel Voice, Probably next week we'll get him on the air. Wrote an incredible story about the resurgence that's happening over there, all surrounding around the train station and Fort Meade and NSA and DISA and all of the other agencies that are based out there. So let's talk about money again. It's near and dear to my heart, as I'm sure it's near and dear to yours. Stock market has been on a bit of a roller coaster ride of late, more high than low at this point. Are we going to stick with this? Where are we going?
You know, I look at the stock market, and the trend has been a very much a bull market. And I wonder, how can this economy support a stock market rally like that? And the answer is, it's not. It's really the Federal Reserve's buying of assets that are pumping up the stock market. Investors are looking to Washington and the dysfunction here over the sequester and the budget battles and saying,
I like that.
Who cares? Who cares? We're going to make money anyhow. Yeah. And we saw in February that employers said, who cares what Washington is doing? Because you know what? Gridlock is not uncertainty. Markets hate uncertainty, but gridlock is not uncertainty. It means you're not going to do anything for a very long time. The politicians can get out of the way and let business do its job. And we saw that in February, and maybe we'll see it in the months to come. I am still very optimistic that gridlock will turn into positive action, which will only help the economy. But right now, we don't have that showing right now.
You had CEOs of these big finance companies come in, these investment houses come in and offer advice almost to the members of the Congress. None of it heated. None of it. These people know how to make money. Look at Apple, for example. Apple has so much money set aside. They have so much cash reserve. They don't know what to do with it. Do we offer a stock split? Do we do this? What do we do with all this cash? We have all. Do we start offering payments back to our investors?
Sure.
Jamie Dimon and look, you smile because you can smell money just from the mere mention of his name. You know, right.
Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan had a little bit of trouble last week, but yes, they are definitely making money hand over fist.
It's a license. He has a license to print money.
Right.
Doesn't matter. He's the Teflon Don at this point. I mean, you would think that barring the issues that they've had of late and even previously, the clawbacks and all that fun stuff that they experienced a while back, you would think that the members of Capitol Hill, members of Congress would kind of listen to them. These guys know how to balance a budget. They know how to make money.
But what they're not doing is investing in the economy. And, you know, February was great, but the trend is that they're not creating the jobs month after month that the economy needs to grow. And when we look at the banking sector, what they're not doing is lending. And that's why we're seeing such tight credit conditions. It's kind of ironic. It may be easier right now to buy a new home rather than an existing home because builders are going to offer concessions. They're going to help you with that down payment. You may not even get out a loan out of J.P. Morgan, but you could get a decent financing rate, a mortgage for 30 years, and a down payment assistance out of a builder. And so we really need banks to take all that cash they're sending on and put it to work for the economy. They're not doing it.
You know what? The builder has an incentive as well. They've got that inventory they got to get rid of. They're paying for it.
Exactly.
So they're gonna work a little bit harder than your neighborhood bank would work to give you money.
Right. Well, the neighborhood bank is probably lending too.
This is true. But the big ones, same thing. You know, you're going to end up with issues.
Good point.
Neela, as always, it's wonderful to have you here to help us decode what we're seeing in the world of finance and housing and jobs. And I hear you're working on something. I'm not going to tell everybody what it is. You got something big.
I have something big for you for next week, so maybe you'll have me on and I'll be happy to talk about it. But the clue is it's about housing.
All right, very good. She's building me a house. All right, secret's out. Neela's giving me a house.
I do have a hammer and a wrench for the weekends.
Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. She's a senior economic analyst here at Bloomberg Government. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'll be back next week with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.